Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tavern Watch, where we talk about things that, well, make us happy in the tabletop space. I am one of your hosts, Joe Perez, and I am joined by the ever magnificent and editor of all things that are great, Liz Harper. How you doing, Liz?
Howdy ho.
And my stalwart companion joins me on yet another journey, because this is our lot in life. We're basically just going to adventure until one of us goes to the afterworld. And that's going to be Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
When you say that's going to be Matt Rossi, you mean I'm the one going to the afterworld?
No,
because I mean, if that's the case, I'm coming back.
I know, you're just going to come back. You're going to be a revenant, if anything.
Yeah, I'm straight up going to crow this. Hi, everybody.
So we haven't done one of these in a while, and we figured that it was time for us to get back on a regular schedule, and this is all due to Liz.
Absolutely, yeah, we have absolutely wanted to, but Liz is the one who got the fire going, so all kudos to Liz.
And also, this is done by you, our wonderful listeners, as well, which thank you for helping us get our numbers back up, which allows us to do shows like this, helps justify it ever so slightly. But we're going to get into some news, and then we're going to get into a couple topics that I think many of you at home have been asking us to weigh in on. So first up, and I'm just going to kind of go through the list here, Chaosium, which is the studio behind Call of Cthulhu, actually has a design challenge out right now. It is one of those really cool things where their Universal Game Engine, which is their basic role-playing Universal Game Engine, which is the really big mouthful for their D100 system, or BRP, they want people to design a game for it. The BRP was released in 2023 under the Orc license and allows creators to use and publish their own games based on its rules without needing to pay royalties. This is kind of cool for a couple of reasons. One, Orc was a response to when Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast and all that wonderful stuff went down with the OGL and the SRD. Mm-hmm. And we've covered that. You could listen to some of our previous ones. The Orc was stood up in response to that. And they're basically saying here, hey, you know what? Use our system. Make your own game. The whole point of this design challenge is to focus on supporting emerging creators and bringing their and helping bring their projects to either digital or print publication. They want concepts that are, want entries that demonstrate originality, concept design, and marketability, and participants can actually submit it. And there's a prize. There's literally, I think it's somewhere in the, I think it's $10,000 prize on top of having your stuff published, which I think is really cool.
Looking at it now, I believe there's like a bunch of there's a $500 prize for like I think that's the short list.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's three winners who will each get an additional $2,000. And there's a Player's Choice Award, which will also get an extra $500. So you've got 3 times 2 is 6. And then, 10 times 5 is 5,000. So you're looking at 11,000 all told in prizes.
Yeah, which is nice.
Which is big for the, for tabletop role-playing game companies. That's big. That's a lot of money.
Would you like to explain why, Matt? Because, I'm sorry, go ahead, Liz.
Is what I'm hearing that the three of us need to design our own game? Is that what's going on now?
I was thinking about it the second I read this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I have that totally not Shadowrun game that I've been working on for the last, 10 years. I could just do it in the BRP and just go from there.
I was thinking of my Ad Astra setting. Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely interested in doing something with this. I might do a couple of things. Because my wife has wanted to publish a game for years. She's got this really great idea, which is essentially the way I described it to other people. It's like, what if Pokemon and Animal Crossing and the farming one that everyone, Stardew Valley, what if they were all one place? And you could basically, you could have Pokemon on your farm and they follow you around and they're your friends. It's not like, so it has elements of Palworld, but not evil. Palworld is straight up evil. That game is scary, but yeah, it's just something I could totally see doing this with it.
Yeah, but and one of the other things I think is real neat about this is too is that Chaosium is emphasizing the importance of ownership and creative control, assuring that this is the important part for those of you listening at home. Entrants will retain full rights to their work without any obligation to transfer intellectual property rights as a condition of entry.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Yep.
This is massive for folks that create games or are thinking about doing it or trying to dip their hat in the ring. Because Matt will tell you, and we've talked about this before, the game industry is relatively dominated by a couple large entities that sort of like they're the outliers. They're not the normal. Most role-playing games are made by smaller companies and published at, you know, sometimes even a loss just to get them out there. They can't compete with the sheer print volume that D&D or Hasbro or Wizards of the Coast or Paizo can even do. And even Paizo suffers to keep up with Hasbro. Yeah.
To give it another way to look at it, Chaosium has been around for decades. They have been publishing games since the late 70s, early 80s.
They did RuneQuest, didn't they?
They did RuneQuest. RuneQuest is the origin of the system they're now calling BURP, basic role playing. Yeah, but the whole, like, for all that they've been putting out Call of Cthulhu forever, for all that they've done the Pendragon game, and Greg Stafford, just before he died, started the most recent edition, which is coming out soon. It's already got like a player's, like a box set for like starters. For all of this, and they've got they had some really big licenses. They, not only did they do the Call of Cthulhu stuff, they had Elric for a while. They had Michael Moorcock's Elric and Stormbringer stories. At the same time, they are minuscule compared to Paizo, which is itself minuscule compared to Hasbro. And that's not, this is not me dogging on Chaosium or its work. Absolutely not. I love Chaosium stuff. I've got some of the, even I've got multiple versions of Call of Cthulhu on the shelf behind me, but it just, you have to be aware of this. Up until fairly recently, like in the 70s, 80s and 90s, the big dog was TSR.
Yes.
And TSR was about the size Paizo is now. That's a ballpark. It's not accurate. Someone who's a real good historian is going to come in here and go, actually, but no, I get it, buddy. I understand. But it was a small but somewhat thriving publishing house. And then they, thanks to someone deciding that we needed a Buck Rogers game real bad, got destroyed. And what's really amazing about all this is how completely the stage is being set again. And we'll talk more about that. But for Chaosium to do this, and for Chaosium to put the rights of creators this forward, it's really interesting. It's in a way, it's interesting because it will not be generating a ton of profit for Chaosium. Mm-hmm. But that's not a problem for Chaosium because they kind of have never really generated much of a profit. Like they haven't been releasing at a loss, but
they've never been that big.
Their focus. Yeah, they've never been that big, and they've never tried to be that big.
And it's really good here too, because like one of the hurdles as somebody who you know, Matt and I have talked about this at length. We've, you know, written stuff. We've looked into getting stuff published. Matt is a published author. It's a pain. And Either, whether you do it yourself, you know, or you try to get somebody to do it for you or pick up your banner. And it's even worse in the tabletop role-playing space because there are no people that are really willing to stick their neck out. And now you see somebody like Chaosium who's willing to do that because they're like, yeah, we will, you know, we'll help you publish it. You retain the rights. Here's a money prize. Let's get your stuff out there.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. It's giving an opportunity that wasn't there before to, in this space. It hasn't been there in decades. Like, yeah, I think
there's indie games. There's a lot of indie games out.
Yes.
And the biggest problem with indie games isn't that they're bad or poorly written or any of that. Quite frankly, some of the best stuff in tabletop is indie stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But up until the past few years, it was practically impossible to be an independent publishing house.
Yeah.
And it's weird how one thing I'll give them credit for this. The people at Critical Role have not always done things right the first time, but their Darrington Press is actually serving to point people at independent creators in a way that hasn't been in a long time. So that's one. This kind of move from Chaosium's two. That's another really good thing. Places like, you know, itch.io, where you can basically put up your stuff and basically sell it yourself. That's helped it a lot, but it's still kind of, at the end of the day, the biggest cost for role-playing games is getting them in paper. And it is very expensive. You really don't know how expensive it is till you start looking at it. And the money margins are not huge in indie role-playing games.
No.
There's a reason that Hasbro was able to dominate the field without even caring about it. And now that they do care about it, you know, in fact, they may actually help end their own dominance. So yeah, this is... It's also rare to see any publisher this open with their SRD document. You know what I mean? Like putting it out on Orc and letting people just do it. Just take it. Take it and go. Do whatever you want. It's even more permissive than the original OGL was. Because the original OGL had, well, you can use our game, but you can't use this.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use our product identity. They're like, just, yeah, everything in this book is yours. Take it. Yeah, you know, we don't care. Take it. Go. Big difference. So yeah, I am fascinated to see how this ends up.
Yeah, and speaking of, unless Liz, you have anything to add, I kind of want to transition.
We're swamping you, so please.
Carry on.
With the evolving of the space also is we're starting to see other games pop up that maybe add a new flavor or a new point of view to traditional tropes. So right now there's a new RPG coming out right now from Japanime Games in collaboration with Son of Oak Game Studio. It's called Queers, a superhero themed tabletop role playing game that emphasizes empathy, love, and inclusivity. So it's designed to, you know, celebrate the LGBTQ+ themes and identity. And it's based off of the City of Mist role playing system, which is recently become one of my favorites for like storytelling because it is a game system designed for cinematic storytelling. Like that's what they built it for, which is really, really cool. And I'm liking, we're seeing more of this. First we saw, Thirsty Sword Lesbians. I think it was the other one.
which is an amazing book. One thing I wanted to talk about was Princesses in Peril.
Yeah, sorry, Princesses in Peril. Peril and the Princesses. Yep.
Because that's one that's very similar in that it's basically about fairy tale princesses who don't want to be saved. They're saving themselves. They're dealing with any of their problems on their own. And it's similar to this, but Queers is better in terms of it. Queers is a different focus, I should say.
And it's based off of a manga by the same name too, by Yasago Fukuda, which if I mispronounce that name, I apologize. It's really cool. And like items and traits can be, you know, things from drag queens wigs to cinnamon rolls. And you use those to overcome and confront adversaries and obstacles. I swear I can talk. I haven't had coffee. I apologize. But I'm going to shut up and let Liz talk if you have any opinions on like this type of stuff entering the space.
I mean, I think one of the most interesting things to have come out of the OGL disaster with Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast is kind of a proliferation of other games. We're talking about Chaosium's system and them pushing to do this with their own ownership, where creators own their content, which is, you look at any contest out there from any industry, any business.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unusual that you retain ownership of what you have created if you enter such a contest.
Even the stuff that you wrote for, like, the WoW contests, like the when they did the short story contest and things like that, you lost the rights to it.
Yeah, immediately. You turn it in, it's not yours anymore. And I think that's really encouraged a lot of even the larger players in the space, like Paizo, like Chaosium. They aren't large, but larger in the space, to go out there and make systems that are very open. And, of course, Chaosium is coming out here and just inviting people to do things. And we're also seeing more varied games, or maybe it's just more varied games that are getting attention. And this is just part of a big trend in the industry that I feel really crystallized with the OGL. The OGL just sort of, that's the wrong phrase, the OGL debacle, where they tried to pull the ability to use the OGL to publish your own content. That really pushed creators to start doing their own things. And it combines with, you know, Kickstarter being out there, to which Kickstarter has caused a huge number of RPGs to be funded, of tabletop games. And when we see games like this, we see different content. We see different kinds of things. Like this Queers game you were just talking about. I just backed something on Kickstarter called Sentai and Sensibility, which is Regency Romance.
Yes.
And also robots.
And yeah, and like, Power Rangers. It's Sentai. Super Sentai.
I can Except never also, love you. I am torn by guilt. My wife died on the heath. To that monster god, now we're going to fight them. But first I have to confess my heart is yours. That was what I did the first time I heard about that one.
Sorry.
Like, seriously, tell me that does not the vibe they are going for.
Mm-hmm. It's great. But these are games. Games like this, we're seeing, would not be published through a traditional publisher. You would not get Hasbro wouldn't publish this, you know, and Dungeons & Dragons. I enjoy Dungeons & Dragons a lot. It's how I got into tabletop role-playing. But, you know, you get some samey...
Oh, my God.
Samey fantasy stuff.
I just realized that the people that make the Sentai and Sensibility game also make the Nancy Druid game.
Yeah.
Sorry, please continue.
Play these things. We have to play all of these things. I mean, I think the biggest problem in the TTRPG space right now is that there is so much variety. There are so many different groups doing different stuff. The problem is, how do you play all of these things? That's the challenge.
Yeah.
And you really can't. I mean, you should never feel guilty that you haven't played something.
But
I'm
going to say something controversial.
Go.
Run more one-shots. Play one more one-shots. Mm. Because I think that's the biggest misconception with tabletop role-playing space is that you have to dedicate yourself to a hefty campaign. And I think, like, this is something we implemented in my core group that we play in Meet Space, which is, you know, if we have a new system, you bring it to the table, you give everybody a pitch on, like, the five-minute elevator pitch, and then you run a, if you are willing to do it and you want to play this, you run a one shot for everybody. And then we try to do that in a regular rotation so that everybody's bringing something to the table if they want to expand their horizons. And it's worked out real well instead of dedicating yourself to like a 3-year campaign when you're just sitting down and playing like a game or two of a setting to get a taste for it and see if you really like it. And I think that's really important.
And if you like one shots, we here at Blizzard Watch actually did quite a few of them and you can listen to them. I'm gonna hype us. I don't care.
And maybe if we find a generous
lot of one shot stuff.
And maybe if we find a generous donor, we can do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna just say this. One of the most fun I've had with our group, and we've actually done a lot of fun stuff. Joe ran a couple of good games, but one of the most fun I had, both as a gamer and a DM, is when I had just homebrewed out of the Powered by the Apocalypse system a Mass Effect game, and these lunatics immediately leapt into it, and Joe played an Elcor, and
happy.
We weren't all like, "Let's be human marines." We were all like, "What's the weirdest thing we could be?"
Mitch's. What was Mitch playing? One of the humans. I want to say a Varric, but it's not Varric. That's a dwarf in a completely different game. Well, you know who I'm talking about, the ones who are like, you know, human meat, those guys. He played one of them and it was great. It was just wonderful.
He did the voice and everything.
Yeah, he did. But he was like, he was a demolitions expert. So that guy was in charge of our demolitions. Yeah. So I do think that one shots are a great idea, and I do think it's a good way to jump around into systems. But one of the other things I love doing with one shots is you basically get to drop it if it's not working. Mm-hmm. Like if people mm-hmm. love it, you can come back to it. But if you try a game and it doesn't gel, like mm-hmm. I loved the game Masks. It's a PBTA mm-hmm. superhero game. Then I went with Monster Hunter. Or was Monster of the Week, I think it was
Monster
called.
Of the Week.
Monster of the Week had a lot of potential, but the game, our group did not gel with it. Mm-hmm. And so we dropped it. And that was fine. It's not that it was bad. I actually liked it quite a bit. But a lot of the other people just didn't seem to get into the idea. Like, you know, they didn't quite grasp what they were being asked to do. So, and if you're in a situation like that, you know, hey, we're going to try this game. Oh, it's not really working. Okay, good. We're done. We've done it. Now we know. So yeah, I absolutely love that idea.
Yeah, and it allows for us to experience a lot of these games a little more frequently. So these games we talk about where there's so many of them and how do you play so many of them, just try to present the idea of running a one-shot every now and then for your groups. Speaking of one-shots, it's also a really good time maybe to consider looking into the Daggerheart game because the open beta has just started this month in March. Go ahead, Liz.
It's starting on the 12th, I believe, which... people listening at home, it may already be live, but as we're recording it, it's in a few days still.
Yeah, but I think it's a really cool idea because, you know, one of the things that really you want to generate interest in your game is not just blind hype. And we talk about this a lot on all of our other podcasts. It's real easy to slap somebody's name, like in this case, you know, Critical Role, onto something and just, you know, put something out and trust that it's people are going to buy it based off of that. It's another thing to want to actually make a good game that people enjoy and actually have people play it before its official release, leveraging your brand recognition as a way to sort of entice people to test your game and give feedback. So like this is going to be doing that right now where it's like you can go to Darrington Press's website or you can go to it's daggerheart.com, which is a subsection of the Darrington Press website, or DriveThruRPG, which is where most online publication for role-playing games are done nowadays, once this goes live, to get a copy of the playtest material with these packets. It'll be done very similarly to when they were doing the new version of D&D way back when that became 5th edition, where they're releasing like packets and play material. They're going to be releasing a character creation tool with Demiplane, set to host the Daggerheart Nexus with the playtesting materials available there as well, if you have that. And then Darrington Press Guild stores will be offering physical playtesting packets to host playtesting sessions at their store. I will rant about that part in a second, but I'm really glad to see this. And it's also using, their system uses the D12, which is a dice that doesn't get a whole lot of love. I think the last time it really received any amount of love was when the Roman Empire still stood and they use it as a D4. No,
that's not true. There's people like me who play barbarians in D&D. For us, mm-hmm. the D12 is around constantly because it's our hit die. It's the damage on a great axe. Yeah, I see D12s all the time. So I'm skewed. I think it's much more commonly used than it actually is. You know, I'm like, D12s are everywhere. No, Matt, you play the weird class that uses them. That's all it is.
I think the D12 thing is funny because when Critical Role first announced that they were going to be doing Daggerheart through Darrington Press, it was like, you know, what kind of game will it be? You know, there was widespread speculation. What kind of game is it going to be? What are they going to do? What kind of dice is it going to use? And it was like, well, their logo is a D20. Of course it's going to be a D20 system. And here they're like, no, D12. This is something that's different. It's a different kind of game. And, you know, not every system has to be a D20 system. We have a lot of systems that come from the same lineage as D&D that stick with the D20. And seeing things that are different is interesting because if you're using a D20 system, in some ways, you're kind of still going back to that lineage. A lot of games on D20 seem to really follow a D&D sort of path. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm totally off with that.
Oh no, you're right. Which is why when we talked about this with Renegade as well, because Renegade again mm-hmm. has the licenses for Power Rangers and Transformers and the upcoming G.I. Mm-hmm. Joe tabletop role playing game. They actually changed the system. They started doing it with the D20 system, and then they realized that the D20 system just would not do or could not do what they wanted. So they created their own system called the Essence system. It uses two D20s, mm-hmm. but it's if you exploded fifth edition and just rebuilt it from the ground up. You can maybe see some of the bare bones, but that's it. It was really well done. And I like that we're not just beholden to the D20 anymore.
Yeah, and what's really fun for me is that as a result of all this, one of the things that's happening is retro clones are coming back. I'm a huge retro clone fan. I love it when a game system... Here's the thing that they don't want to tell you. Hasbro is very careful not to ever mention this. You can't copyright a game.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You can copyright stuff in the game.
Mechanics or things like that.
Yeah, no, not mechanics.
Not mechanics, terminology.
Yeah, you can copyright terminology. You can copyright, Illithids, or, you can't copyright dragons, obviously, but you can make up specific new monsters and you can copyright and trademark them.
A really good example of that is if you play Magic the Gathering, the concept of tapping a card is copyrighted. The action and symbol is not.
Yeah, because it can't be.
But in Lorcana, it's called Exhausting, or I think it's also called Exhausting in the new Star Wars game. But it's the same mechanic. It's just called something different. It just can't be called the same thing.
And that kind of thing means that when games go out of print for whatever reason, mm-hmm. People can basically just take the system, change all the names, and publish it. And I wrote a post about this a couple of years back because when I found one that I really loved called Phaserip, FaserIp. And it was called that because it was basically a straight-up riff of the original Marvel Superheroes role-playing game that TSR, the D&D publisher, put out back before Wizards bought D&D.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And why that's funny is, first off, TSR did not think you should use a D20 for everything.
Mm-hmm.
They did not use the same system for all of their games. Boot Hill, which is their cowboy game, completely different system. Top Secret, their spy game, completely different system. Gamma World used a similar system. They still use D20s and stuff, but that's because Gamma World was trying their kind of a post-apocalyptic future D&D game. So they wanted to keep it somewhat connected so you could take characters from one book and play it in the other game. But they didn't always do that. And Alternity is a really good example when they put out their Alternity system. Completely different system. And I like seeing it because then you can get the retro clones. People are out there making retro clones now, and they can get them published because they can just publish them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I'm loving seeing. I'm a huge fan of Phaserip. Phaserip is basically, they can't actually use the Phaserip system they used in the original system because those were actual names for the ranks. You can't do that. There was fighting, agility, strength, endurance, resistance, reason, intellect, and psyche. Those were the stats. And that's why they call the game Phaserip, because it's just the stats from the original system. And it's hilarious to me. And it's a good game too, by the way. I picked it up. I played it. I ran a superhero game with it. It's nice. Mm. I liked it. But it's one problem is that it uses charts. You don't roll like a D20 and just know, okay, that succeeds, that fails. There's literally a huge chart of the difficulties and the stats you have and whether or not your character could do that thing. And you roll dice to see if you can push your result up into a success.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very complicated. It is quite frankly, it's almost unplayable.
But that's why you play now things. You can play things like the Daggerheart open beta to see if it is playable or not. And also solicit your feedback and make sure that you give a response through, which is what they're looking for here, right? Like they're looking to make sure that the game system isn't too complicated, that players can easily get around it. So Daggerheart also uses like a card system, right?
They have two dice and then they have cards. It actually sounds really kind of fascinating because if you remember Everway, it's kind of like Everway.
A little bit.
Hmm. Yeah, a little bit.
But I mean, there are things that like way you build your character grant you different actions or different cards available to you. It gives you different things like your subclass and domain cards to help shape your character. And you get to craft your character through those cards. And basically, that's what your character sort of is born and runs as. It's really interesting. And you were saying something, Liz. I apologize.
I'm hoping to get to that. We can get together and run a game soon after this is released and check it out ourselves because it does sound really interesting. I personally got into tabletop role playing watching Critical Role, so I'm interested to see what they come up with building something of their own.
Yeah, I want to see. I'm quite frankly, I am concerned but also curious to see what Talos and Jaffe unleashes on us because that man is dark.
That aside, I think maybe we do a playtest run of this because this is the thing that I was going to rant about. Right now, the Darrington Press Guild Store list is woefully small. I know I personally from on my retail location, we have messaged and applied multiple times and have heard nothing back. And I know most stores that I know that have tried to do the same have also met silence. And I don't know if it's just that they're overwhelmed with the demand, which is entirely possible.
I think that is probably very likely because as big as we think Critical Role is in terms of its, you know, footprint, there's not a lot of people working there.
Yeah.
Enterprise
it's a small organization.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll see that number increase. In the meantime, you're going to likely want to download the packets and go from there, which I think maybe we can convince some people to give it a try, at least through here.
I realize I didn't respond to the email because, you know, again, life dumpster fire, but I would like to play it. I would like to see what kind of character I can come up with. I actually already have a character concept for it.
Well, then definitely. I'm trying to get everyone's schedules together and see if we can get a game run and maybe do a podcast of it.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, we'll see. It's this is the behind the scenes how the podcast gets made. It's really sending a lot of emails and it's saying, hurting cats. Okay, when are you available? When are you available? But when are you available? And then, you know, it's like
scheduling.
It's like you're looking at this spreadsheet and trying to see when these times and people match up. So, yes, I hope we can do that because it'd be interesting to check out a game in development, because like when D&D was doing its playtesting for its latest edition, like they kept releasing playtest material, but they didn't release it in a way that was conducive to playtesting, if that makes sense.
It's because definitely a situation where you were like supposed to take like just this one new thing and play it in your normal D&D game instead of here's a system. Play this entire system. Yeah, it was definitely.
It's like
it's weird because they did it so right for D&D Next. Remember that, Joe? Uh-huh. They did it so right. They got it right to the point where Joe and I were like, both, I want to play D&D again, huh? And then they're not doing it right this time, and it's like, what, why? I know you still have some people there who know how to do this. Why are you not doing it? It is strange. Yeah,
they released it so piecemeal. It's like, here's a few classes, here's a list of spells, but they never updated. Like when they changed something, they didn't update the old playtest material. So it's like you had to read the old playtest material and then also read all of the new playtest material to see how things had been modified and what rules had changed. It just wasn't conducive to sitting down and saying, okay, let's playtest this game. Let's playtest this new system. because you had to kind of fit the new parts into the old parts, and you had to keep up with every rules change as it was coming down the pipeline. They did not make it easy, but this sounds like they're just going to give you a game package, and you're going to go in and run it and play it. So I'm looking forward to trying this out, you know, kind of get it on the ground floor, see what it's like.
Joe, you should jump onto the Heroescape thing. You want to talk about that?
I was absolutely going to. I was actually going to do a nice little segue there because you talked about reviving old games. And right now, I actually do want to talk about Heroescape, which some of our listeners may remember back in the late 80s, early 90s was a miniature wargaming board game that wound up getting purchased by Hasbro at some point. A couple of years ago, it tried to get revived. It was finally remembered. It had, you can go back and there's a ton of commercials on YouTube that you can look up for. Like it was knights and dragons and wizards and actual firing cannons and actual firing like trebuchets and ballistas and stuff like that. It was a really cool little board game that sort of bridged the gap between tabletop war games and a traditional like flat punched down board game. Fans really loved it. And then when Hasbro got their hands on it, well, of course, it just kind of went away. They tried to revive it a couple years ago, and it failed miserably. It just couldn't really...
I think 2004? Was it 2004?
It was 2004, I believe. And then what wound up happening is Renegade, the folks that make the Power Rangers board game, that make the Power Rangers, Transformers, and soon-to-be G.I. Joe RPGs... who have been working with a lot of the Hasbro IPs that Hasbro has basically decided they don't want to do anything with, said, we want to do this. And so now we have the refreshed Age of Annihilation coming out this year. Now, originally, the part of the reason that it failed beforehand was that the box was going to be $250. That's a steep price to pay for a board game. Now, don't get me wrong, back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was an expensive board game. It was like $60 to $80 in like 90s money. But you got a lot of stuff. You got two complete factions and a whole bunch of models. And people who played war games at the time would actually routinely buy that box because it was a better value instead of buying actual plastic figures for Warhammer. In this one, though, they have said that they're not going to do crowdfunding. They're going straight to retail. And they're going to do more economical boxes available aside from just the big master box. So the master set lowers the asking price to $125 for 20 unpainted miniatures, 74 interlocking hex tiles, walls, and 9 pre-written combat scenarios. The Battle for Wellspring battle box will cost $45 for 6 unpainted miniatures, only found in a beginner-oriented kit, along with 31 tiles and a unique terrain feature only available for that box set, and as well as 4 scenarios with it. It's a really smart way to approach this as somebody who spent a lot of time and money and literally has just spent $300 on models on Friday. like this is really smart to revive this game, make it accessible maybe to more people. One, that lower price point for the master box, $125 is really reasonable. It's cheaper than any other like plastic wargaming box set you can buy right now. And the idea of having like smaller beginner boxes to dip your toes in that still give you a lot of value for that money. Because again, $45 for 6 unpainted miniatures sounds like a lot. Literally, I have a box of 5 unpainted miniatures sitting directly to me, like right here, right now. And here, you're going to hear the rattle. That was $72 because, and it didn't come with bases. It didn't come with scenarios. It didn't come with the board game tile stuff because it's for a war game. This is exceptionally reasonable. And I know a lot of people are really excited about it. And the interesting thing too, is instead of just having it be a standalone board game that you buy and then you're done, they're actually trying to do an organized play scenario or like an organized play setup with it where, when the Wave 1 boxes release, there's going to be competitive play for this like a war game, but they're going to keep the game alive and keep producing new stuff for it, whether it's new scenarios, not just new models, but like new things to enjoy with the game. And that will solve the problem that Heroescape had in the first place, which was once you bought a box of Heroescape in the old days, you were done. There was nothing else. It's a really smart way of doing it. And they're looking at this year, August of 2024, it will release. And then by 2025, by the time Gen Con 2025 rolls around, they will have the organized play set up and there will actually be regional championships for it, which I think is really cool. And I'm going to shut up and let Matt or Liz talk about this if you have any opinions whatsoever.
I remember HeroScape, but it wasn't something I was tremendously invested in. I just think I'm going to just say this because we're going to talk about it more later, I'm sure. The idea that Hasbro, which owns two of the biggest voices in game design, they own Avalon Hill Games, which is a board game giant.
They made all of the old RPG, like fantasy role play or board games back in the day.
Yeah. And they own Wizards of the Coast, which is the guys who make D&D, and they couldn't get HeroScape off the ground and they had to let someone else license it.
This, not just license it, market it and price it.
Everything is being done by Renegade. Nothing is being done by Hasbro. They get paid a lump sum for the rights and that's it. And that to me shows you the danger to the hobby that Hasbro has become, that their moves are rooted solely in short-term profit. They don't seem to understand the industry that they've blundered into. And like, think about this. HeroScape was a marketable property. It's in this world where we see so many nostalgia-based revivals, this thing had it all for a big swath of people who are now in their like 30s, 40s, and 50s. They have disposable income and they're willing to spend it. And you couldn't relaunch it. And not only could you not relaunch it, you had to get someone else to relaunch it. I guarantee we're going to talk more about this, but I want people to keep that in their head as we move through some of the more news and get to like the topics. I want you to think about this. What is this telling you about where Hasbro's priorities are? Hasbro doesn't want to make games.
They want to make money.
They want to own games and get other people to make them.
Well, the thing I get about Hasbro is that, you know, they bought Wizards of the Coast and this wasn't about D&D. This was about Magic the Gathering. You know, they wanted
and Pokemon.
They wanted into this big business, and you know, D&D was just kind of there. They didn't, as you've been saying, they didn't know what they had,
and it thrived under their lack of knowledge.
Exactly. They didn't really know. It was just a thing that was there, and they didn't care about it. And so it was allowed to do its own thing. But now they've realized that D&D is a valuable property. D&D can make money. And so now they're looking to maximize that. But Hasbro has never had an understanding of the industry and certainly didn't buy Wizards of the Coast or get into this business out of a knowledge of TTRPGs or an interest in TTRPGs. They've found themselves in this place and they're thinking, oh, this is a way to make money. They never knew the industry, and they haven't really tried to since they've started really pushing D&D to be a big moneymaker with lots of fancy books and digital book packages they've been pushing, more and more releases, more expensive releases. Game tie-ins, we have talked about their virtual tabletop system, which could be a microtransaction disaster. We don't know that it's going to be, but that's certainly a fear. So they've gotten into the industry without knowing or caring about it, and they're just stumbling along, trying to make a buck.
And I think maybe we just go right to that topic then, because we have a bunch of other news stuff that I did want to get through, but I think we're ripping the Band-Aid off of this one, and we can always come back to the news and maybe a little bit of happier stuff. But yeah, like let's talk about that. Let's talk about the recent tragedy of Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast and D&D and the future of the product, but not just the future of that product, the future of all the products that Hasbro essentially owns at this point. I think if you haven't been following along, there's been a lot of controversy over this in the last few years, whether it was with them trying to suspend the OGL and create a very restrictive one where they would steal your IP. And now with like things like the recent firing of, what was it, 1,900 people, I think it was 30% of the workforce, a lot of them coming from Wizards of the Coast. which is their only profitable division, I want to point out. It was their only profitable division that Hasbro owns. And they cut most of their workforce. They cut their community team. Community team has been fired and moved off. They've canceled all of the content creation that they had lined up. They sold off their streaming property that nobody knew existed. Canceled the Dragonlance TV show that was coming out that Joe Manganiello was going to be heading up as an executive producer and showrunner. They sold off their movie company that they bought for an extreme value, extreme money cost, and then sold it at a huge loss. And then books have been delayed. The next D&D is going to be delayed till the middle to end of this year, when it was already supposed to be out at the time of this recording. Like, we were already supposed to have the new player's handbook like a week before today. And then getting on their investor calls, and Chris Cox, and I'll call him up by name because I really don't care. What are you going to do to me, buddy? Goes on and says that he wants to make all these changes to monetize things further. Like, I'll go back to the Magic the Gathering stuff a little bit because I think it's relevant here in the grand concept or scheme of things. Magic does this thing called Universes Beyond. And it's a cool idea where instead of doing traditional Magic cards set in the traditional Magic setting, they get the rights to different IPs from different other companies and produce cards for the Magic the Gathering game. They did this with Warhammer 40K. They made a deal with Games Workshop. They made four decks that were pretty wild, well-received, sold really well, and made a lot of people happy and got a lot of people to pick up some really cool art and some cards and injected some sci-fi into a traditionally fantasy setting. They did the same thing now with Lord of the Rings, which this is where the problem starts. Lord of the Rings sold incredibly well to the tune of $220 million by itself. That doesn't sound like a lot, but this is a one-time limited release that they pushed out there. You can't get it anymore. It's not in production anymore. What you got was what you got, and they made that much money. But then Chris Cox looks at that and says, oh, all of them can make this much money or more. We just had the next one release recently, which was Fallout, another beloved series. People seem to really enjoy that. And now we're going to have another one coming out this year, which normally we only get one per year. Now it's two, maybe three per year, and I'll get into that in a second. But now we're going to have Assassin's Creed coming out later this year, actually within a few months. And these would be what were once kind of nice treats that happened once in a while are now happening with more frequency, to the point where Chris Cox in that meeting said, we're going to stop making one of our regular products a year to make another one of these special products at a higher price point, actively harming the game that people play that have been playing competitively since the 90s or playing for fun or playing in tournaments, whatever the case is, actively hurting the pool of cards for most formats in order to try to grab more collectors. People who don't actually play the game but just want to spend money. And that sort of is the same idea of what they're going with Wizards of the Coast's everything, whether it's D&D, whether it's any of the other possible IPs. They don't care about the longevity of it. The current leadership at Hasbro, I mean, we get one per podcast, and I think I'm going to use it here. They don't give a fuck, right? Straight up. All they care about is the short-term games. They care about, you know, can we monetize this? What can we get out of it? And then when it starts to fail, what can I do to make sure I get my golden parachute out? The people that are in charge don't play these games. They don't care about these games because they don't even want to learn about them. These are executives that used to work at Xbox or EA and, you know, care about loot boxes and care about monetization and care about digitizing and trying to cut out distribution so that you don't have to have local game stores carrying your product when you can just entice people to come to your website and buy it, to the point where they were actually producing books that you could buy early, not from your local game store, but directly through them, that included a digital copy. Something they won't do for local game stores, despite the fact that local game stores have been asking for that specifically for years. Hey, you have digital content distribution. Can we maybe get codes so that when people buy the book from us, they can get digital content as well? Nope, you're not allowed to do that. Hey, by the way, we're going to do that. They don't care. They don't care about supporting the community at this point anymore. The people in charge don't care about the longevity of their games. They care about how much money they can get in the short term. And they don't even care about the people that make these games for them that produce this money. That's the current state of Wizards of the Coast, because of Hasbro. And it's a grim future for D&D as a result of it. And I'm going to shut up and let Liz and Matt talk because it's heavy. It's a lot.
Yeah, Liz, do you want to go or do you want me to go?
I just have one thing I think about here, which is that I think the proof of this in one way or another is going to be in the books. And we have not seen the books, and they are going to be out for quite a while to come. So, I mean, it sounds bad. There are lots of potential bad directions this could be going in. Some of the playtest content I liked, some of it I didn't like so much. But in the end, I want to see the result. I want to see what the game actually looks like, what it actually turns into. So I'm in the middle of the road here. I'm not going to say doom and gloom, nothing possibly good can come of this, but I'm certainly hesitant. I need to see what they're doing before I'm going to make a final judgment call here. But it does not sound good right now.
Matt?
Okay. I'm going to list some of the people that got laid off. Just some of them. Magic the Gathering's creative, Magic the Gathering's director, Mike Merles, mm-hmm. got laid off. before he was at Magic the Gathering, he was a Dungeons & Dragons creative director. Amy Dallin, who's the D&D Beyond host and producer, she does a lot of their, did a lot of their media outreach. The D&D senior development editor, Eitan Bernstein, Larry Froom, who is their senior communications manager, and their art director, Bree Heiss.
Mm-hmm.
Some employees straight up just opted, you know, to leave. They just retired early. They don't have a list of that yet. But as a lot of people have pointed out, Joe already mentioned that Wizards was Hasbro's only profitable division. And that's been the case for a while, that the Wizards actually makes money while other parts of Hasbro do not. In the course of like the last year, before the layoffs happened, they put out a movie which didn't make a ton of money, but it was, people liked it. It got good press. Even after it came out, the reviews were not like, oh God, Jeremy Irons destroyed my life. They were like, you know, this is actually fun. This is a fun movie.
It was a genuinely good movie.
Yeah. They also put out the most successful video game of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
Not just game of the year, which it was by so many lists, it won so many awards, but a straight up financial success. The game sold like crazy. It's still selling. And otherwise, like that thing that Joe just mentioned about how they put out the Lord of the Rings pack and it just generated $250 million, that's a quarter of $1 billion. And I mean, think about this. If all of that doesn't make you safe, then you're never going to be safe working there. I wanted to mention all that because I think it fires into what we were talking about with Renegade.
Mm-hmm.
Where Hasbro just decided rather than have its own people do this, they would just take a lump sum from Renegade and let them take all the risks. And this goes back to something that Liz has talked about with video game development all the time, that companies in video game development are extremely adverse to risk.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I'm going to point out something that we also saw last year. Wizards of the Coast has a game studio that is a video game studio.
Mm-hmm.
And that game studio is making a game. That game was debuted at the Game of the Year Awards.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And the game studio is owned by Wizards. It's run by Wizards. And the people at it are people who used to be at BioWare. James Olin, Drew Karpyshyn, they're the Exodus is the name of the game. They're the ones making that game for them. Think about what that says for where Wizards of the Coast is going to be in 5 years. If you've got people who come to the company from video game development, who want to turn the company into essentially a video game, Like that's always been something they want. They want to make virtual tabletops the big deal. And I mean, I love virtual tabletops. I think we all do. We all use them. But they basically want to get rid of the messy social stuff that is a big part of tabletop role playing, and basically just find ways to generate money. And the problem is that the core audience for all these different kinds of games, I don't know how to put this. Like, when they did what they did with the OGL, they yanked out what was basically a tent pole that was holding a lot of things up. And it was basically propping Wizards up, because Wizards was getting by on people's trust.
Mm-hmm.
People in the gaming community trusted them.
Mm-hmm.
They went out and made games using their game license because they trusted them, because Wizards was going with a strategy that they came up with in the early 2000s, where the whole purpose of letting people use your game engine meant, A, they were no longer competing with you in making their own game engines, because yours was everywhere, so they were just using yours, which meant that anything they put out was a supplement to your game.
Mm-hmm.
And you would therefore be funneled back to it. Even if you just, like, a game as big as EverQuest, when it got a role-playing game, was just D&D. It used the OGL. They just straight up put the SRD into their game. If you were playing the EverQuest tabletop role-playing game, you were playing D&D. And Wizards knew it. But the new Wizards doesn't know it, because it's headless. The people who run the company do not understand what they're doing.
The best way that I've heard it put, and I think this is really what it goes in, that the thing that makes D&D and like Magic what they are is the gathering. It is people coming together and sitting down at a table, playing a game together that they enjoy. You know, it's not, because it's, when you strip D&D of that factor, it's generic fantasy number 7. Right. Mm-hmm. When you strip Magic the Gathering of that the sitting down at a table and playing it, it's just generic fantasy number 6. And that's the gathering, the people that play these games, the community surrounding it, and the fact that they are games is what made them successful and what made them profitable. When you start stripping away the people aspect, you start stripping away the game, and you start focusing on the collectability of it, or you start focusing on the virtualization of it, or you start focusing on single player. That's the other thing. That's the other thing that really that sort of irritated me too. And we didn't talk about this, and maybe this comes up as well, because I think it plays into this. When they were talking about their virtual tabletop, they were talking about having AI or automated dungeon masters. They were talking about essentially having it so that you could have a robot or a machine run you through a game just like you would if you were playing a video game, completely eliminating the factor of a human being behind that DM screen and reacting to what you're doing, making it much more linear and ruining the fun of it. I think I know for Matt, but for me, when I run a game, the random BS that my party comes up with and makes me have to react and pivot to is the fun.
Look at when Liz was running Witchlight.
Oh yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, Liz was continuously having to react to our weirdness.
Well, and just worked. Think we were playing Pathfinder a few weeks ago, and one of our players picked a fight with a squirrel and lost.
Yep.
So, yep. He lost.
I think he would say it was a draw, but still,
he would be lying.
That's not something that was in the published adventure. No, that's just something you have to run with on the fly.
Well, of course, one of the problems. Yeah, I just want to mention this because it ties into that. I was watching some video content talking about D&D, and one of them was like, "Yes, DM, I want to see. I'm going to use my wish in game to look behind the DM screen and see the notes for the campaign." And the GM was like, "I don't think you're going to enjoy this, but go ahead." He goes, "Where are the notes?" He goes, "I've been winging it.
Yeah,
this entire time. Like, I started off somewhere, y'all went off the rails, and I have been literally just winging it since." And that's something. Talking about, you know, they want to make it a video game. It's not that video games are bad. It's not that virtual tabletops are bad. It's not that playing through them is bad. It's that you can't forget that these are tools to facilitate play.
Yep.
They are not the game. They are tools that we use to play the game. And as long as that's what you're doing, you're fine. But once you start trying to make it like, you know, the whole, I laugh at the AI game thing. We're going to have an AI game master. Good. Let's see how that works out for you. There are people out there trying to use ChatGPT to write law papers, and they can't pull that off. But you think they can run an interactive improvisational game? Let's find out. You know, that's a Turing test, man.
Oh, boy. I mean, the thing about AI as it is, ChatGPT, is that, you know, it consumes a lot of content and then it regurgitates it. It kind of mixes and matches. It's meant to mimic language. It's meant to mimic the language it's been trained on. So we were just talking about D&D being generic fantasy number 7 or whatever. If you feed that through an AI, you only get even more of that. Because you're telling an AI, okay, look at all of this generic fantasy stuff that makes up this world. Now make up something new. Except it's literally not capable of making up something new. It's looking at whatever you fed it and mixing it up in a way that sounds like a real sentence that's really real.
And we already had riffs in the 90s. We don't need this.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead.
It just seems ludicrous to me that they're pushing AI as kind of the future. And I think the entire tech industry is sort of leaning a little more heavily on AI than the technology really warrants. This is interesting technology, but it still remains kind of a novelty because it's a language model. It's designed to mimic human language. It's not intelligent. It can't discern fact from fiction. It cannot create anything new. It can only remix things.
It doesn't have human judgment.
Yes, it has. It's not even that it doesn't have human judgment. It doesn't have any judgment. So,
and I mean,
it's
for that
mixing
matter,
things up, but
yeah, absolutely. And for that matter, actual effective remixing is not something it does.
No, it just
can't, because actual effective remixing uses artistic choice.
Mm-hmm.
It weighs things. What this is, in the end of the day, is the tech industry really wanting to come up with a system where they don't have to pay anyone to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it goes back to why Hasbro licensed Renegade instead of putting out the game themselves. They don't want to be involved in that. They don't want to pay people to do things. Renegade's doing all that themselves. Renegade paid Hasbro for the rights. You know, Hasbro didn't pay Renegade to do it. Hasbro got money and Renegade's doing it. That's the model they want. They want a model where they don't have to spend anything to make money.
And going back to like the root of it. So with this all in mind and looking back on what this means for the future of these games like D&D, it's uncertain, right? And D&D was made and 5th edition in particular is made by a lot of people that were very passionate about the content that they made. And they wanted very hard to make a game system that everybody enjoyed, that people loved. And they did that. And it was pretty ubiquitous for a while. And those people, I hope, remain in the industry. The people that are no longer with the company, the people that have chosen to leave, or the people that were removed from the company. D&D may never be the same. D&D itself isn't what made it special, though. It's the people that make it and the people that play it. And so instead, I think the future is going to be Hasbro is going to muck it up. That's what they're going to do. They're going to continue to do what they've been doing. They're going to cannibalize it until it starts losing them more money than it makes them. And they determine that it's not profitable anymore. And then maybe they'll sell it off. Or maybe they'll just let it languish as a thing that they can dust off every 5 years and license to somebody. Or maybe they will just fully license both games to other companies. But the future is going to be what we players make of it. If you want to keep playing D&D, there's no harm in that. Nobody's going to judge you, and that's fine. But there are so many other games coming out as a result of this. Hasbro's making a very public mess up of D&D. And let's be honest, role players are smart. We read a lot. And we tend to notice when the big bad villain is doing something we don't like. And so a lot of us are taking our ball and going elsewhere. Like at the time of this recording, I just finished a shift at the shop. And I can tell you, without a doubt, the most asked question I get is, what other games besides D&D are there? A year ago, I wouldn't have gotten that. A year ago is, when's the next D&D book coming out? Can you reserve me a special cover? Can you, you know, give me a special set of dice for D&D? Now it's, hey, what about Blades in the Dark? Or, hey, can you get Avatar in for me? Or, hey, can you get me Pathfinder in this book and this new book that Pathfinder is coming out with? I've been getting asked a ton of when I'm going to get Tianxia, the world books in for the world guide and the character creation for it. Like, these are starting to become more prevalent, and it's very apparent to at least me anecdotally, and from what I see online, that Hasbro is losing its core audience for D&D, and we're starting to look elsewhere. And that's where the future of this really is. And
yeah, the thing to mention too is that the stories we've been covering, the stuff we talked about in the news section, one of them is Darrington Press's Daggerfall. The other was the KOCM, using the Orc license to basically tell people, go ahead and make games, make your game with our game system. Both of those are self-inflicted wounds on Hasbro.
100%.
Because Critical Role wasn't making a role-playing game. They didn't have to. They made D&D popular. Everybody liked D&D because of them in a large chunk. They
let's not forget,
spread the word.
Let's not forget, they started in Pathfinder and then moved to D&D.
Yeah, exactly. When D&D 5e came out, they moved to it. They did a lot of the work Hasbro needed done to get people to play it. And by doing what they did with the open gaming license, by basically saying we can change it whenever we want, first thing that happened was all the people that were there when it was written were like, ah, no, that is not what the license means. We set up an independent, you know, company that it's a nonprofit that just administers that license. You can't just change it whenever you want. That was the point of open gaming, that you can't change it. And the second thing that happened was all those companies that were using the OGL in one way or another realized that Hasbro, which is a $1 billion company, could try and take their ball, and they just sue them into the ground. You couldn't fight this. How are you going to fight this? Your company has three people working. Go ahead, Liz. I'm sorry.
And also Hasbro was asking for a huge amount of royalties from anyone who kept making their content. And they backed off on all of that for now, but you've got to have a lot of creators out there.
For going, now is the key
okay,
part
well,
there.
Yeah, for now.
For now. They've backed off for now, but they clearly think they can do this and make these changes whenever they want. So what happens next time when they start to demand more royalties? What happens the time after that? Well, maybe now is the time for me to start thinking of different systems that I own, systems that are under a real open license that I can lean into and use and still own my own creations without having to pay. It was something like 50% for Kickstarter campaigns.
Yeah, the Kickstarter
For big Kickstarter campaigns, it was going to be something like, okay, you owe them 50% off the top before you get into anything.
Yeah, or you can make the thing you kickstarted, you have to give them half the money.
Yeah.
And think about, too, like, as Liz is pointing this out, stop and think about how many of those Kickstarters, they're big money by small standards.
Well,
like, Avatar, Kate, was one of the most successful. Coyote and Crow was another really successful one.
But look at how much they were asking for.
Yeah.
Like, they did exponentially well. They did well more than they asked for, but they were asking for the bare minimum. What they needed to get the game produced and out and published into people's hands.
If you succeeded, but not that well, if you had only made, like, say you put up, like you know, I need 65,000 in order to get this book published, printed, and distributed, and pay everyone who's going to work on it, and then I'll have maybe like $1,000 left over. Well, good luck, because Hasbro wants half of your Kickstarter, and if you make your target goal, you will not make your target goal.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, and the thing about this, we're talking about it, like, that Hasbro can come back and do it whenever they want. The mentality that made them think they could do it in the first place is the mentality of somebody who does not understand generating goodwill. And how valuable goodwill is. That I talked about trust earlier. The trust that everybody had that they could put stuff out and basically drive business to Hasbro. Because that's the thing. People keep forgetting this. The original open gaming license drove business to Wizards of the Coast. You still had to buy the player's handbook if you wanted to use this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they just 20 something years of goodwill where people were basically doing the thing that Wizards wanted them to do, flushed. And now we're here where, like, I want to throw out, like we were talking earlier, I want to mention quickly, one of the things that's happening this year, after last year, when we got the Pathfinder revision thing, the project where they were like trying to take all the OGL stuff off of Pathfinder and make it a game that they don't have to worry about, that is they're now putting out a beta for Starfinder second edition.
Yeah.
And this is a game that I want to play test. Like I want to get this group of people. I want to get like Liz and Joe.
This
and
is a game that people. I will want to play test because I love Starfinder.
I'm very curious about this myself. So, like, Matt, can you tell me what kind of playtest stuff are they putting out? Is it something that's kind of like D&D where they're putting it out piecemeal, or no, is it something that we can dive into?
They're putting out a rule book. It is essentially the rule book, but not playtested yet. Mm-hmm. So when you play it, you could go right to them and say, "Hey, I really like what you're going for, but unfortunately, this class doesn't work." And that kind of thing. It's essentially like when they did Pathfinder second edition, I had the playtest version. Like I downloaded it and it was a 300 page rule book. You could sit down with it just like you can that with a live game and just play it. And then you would discover really early, like I did, that the barbarian didn't work. it wasn't terribly broken. It was just like, your first level barbarian's okay. Second level barbarian's okay. Your third level barbarian's a gore machine who will kill absolutely everything in his path. But 10th level barbarians start dying like flies because they made changes based on that feedback. Yeah, that's how it worked.
And to put it into context, what you're going to get in it, because I think it's relevant here to show how committed they are to the player experience. The rulebook will have six classes, including the Envoy, Mystic, Operative, Solarian, Soldier, and Witch Warper. New Ancestries, which is their version of what, you know, lineages, heritages, or races, as some people call them, feats, spells, a new equipment system. And the idea is to provide as many tools as possible for a Starfinder game, along with some of the new systems and tweaks necessary for running a science fantasy game. When 2025 rolls around, we'll be splitting this content into their appropriate player and GM-facing books. Please note the Starfinder playtest rulebook will not have any special edition covers or hardback editions, as it's intended to be released as a soft cover book. That's huge, because that means it's going to be cheaper. I love their soft cover rulebooks for Pathfinder. I think that they're one of the best things that they've ever made, because I have too many large books. I literally have bookshelves bowing from how many RPG books I have on them. And the PDF for this product will be made freely available at launch.
Yeah, I will have it.
Wow.
Second it launches, I will have it. Because you can. You can just download it. They did that with Pathfinder too.
Yeah, they're like, this is the future of RPG content, right? Like, these companies are seeing what's happening. And in fact, Paizo is made from people that used to make D&D. There are several of them that are sitting there. There's people that work at Chaosium that used to work on D&D. The gaming industry is full of these people that are expatriates, and now there's 1900 more of them. Thanks, Hasbro. That are looking to, one of the things I thought was always most interesting was when we started talking about like video games and other things. And I will call out Pirate Software for this as well, because it applies to tabletop as well, is if you want a game to be made, just make the game you want. And that's what these people are doing. They're making the games they want, and they're helping like solidify the communities that are being disenfranchised by Hasbro just not giving a darn anymore about the players or the game. Right. I really want to swear so much today. You have no idea, folks. But Paizo is like, look, we want people to play our games. We want people to have fun. We want people to get together and, you know, go on space opera joy rides with their ships and feel invested in this game. And, you know, the game is good. We want to make money, sure, but we want people to enjoy and play the game. And the idea of having lower price point books, lowering that barrier to entry, which is massive for games. The cost of a new D&D book is going to be $70.
Yeah, for one book.
For one book. One book is going to be around $70.
Last year, Wizards of the Coast put out six books over the course of the year. So yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot.
And think about that. Like, you've gone from having to spend, back in the old days, $100 was expensive, but it got you all three books and you needed nothing else. Now you're going to need $210 just for the core books. And you will need
nothing else because they're going to put out a PHB 2 relatively soon after.
Yeah.
You know, and
which they've said. They flat out said.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're going back to fourth edition, basically, where they're going to have a new player's handbook every like year that adds more stuff to it because they want more money from you. They want to serialize the content that they're selling you. Whereas
they need it to be a drip. Yeah.
Whereas Paizo is like, hey, we're going to make this book and maybe we'll make two books this year. Or, you know, maybe we'll do.
Paizo does make a lot of books.
They do. What
Paizo does is a lot of their
rules. If you look at their adventure paths, there's like a new adventure path every month.
Yeah, but not just that. Like, for instance, we mentioned the Tian Za book that's coming out. It has both the world guide and character guide. Mm-hmm. That's if you want to play. You don't have to do either of those books to do Tian Za. You can just play there. The thing about Pathfinder is, especially with the new system that they've come up with, you've got three or so rule books, and they're cheaper than D&D, but they're still up there. They're pricey, but those are all you need. And there's multiple formats of them. You can get them in PDF, which is way cheaper. You can get them as soft cover. And when Paizo does a PDF, they just sell you the PDF.
Yeah.
You can just buy it. You don't have to buy it from D&D Beyond.
You don't have to have it locked to a site. You can download it. You can put it on whatever the heck you want.
Yeah. And a lot of this is just common sense that's how it should work. But a lot of it is just also they want to be accessible. And that's the thing that D&D has always lagged behind on is accessibility. And they were making some decent strides in the past couple of years. When Pathfinder came out with ditched races and did a bunch of stuff, D&D followed suit because they realized, oh, wow, other people are doing this. We have to do it now. So, yeah, I there's so much to talk about here. And by the way, that Fallout MTG set, it didn't sell out nearly as fast as Lord of the Rings. Joe had mentioned this earlier. I want to make
sure. No, not even. I still have product left in my shop right now.
And that's going to continue because only some franchises are Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And that's a really good example. Like, and not to go back to it, but like I have people that still come into the shop and ask for Lord of the Rings, not because they have any intention of playing the game. They just love Lord of the Rings. It still would sell if I can get it in. Fallout's niche, right?
And Assassin's Creed is niche. Yeah. I am the Fallout niche, guys. I am the person. I don't play Magic. I've never bought a Magic deck in my life.
But despite how much you love it, you're not gonna buy those decks.
I might buy the Fallout one. I might, sir. I might. You might get me there, but you're not getting me on Assassin's Creed unless someone was like, by the way, there's like 30, there's 300 Cassandra cards of different type. Oh, you almost got me. Almost got me.
There are only 12 and I'll send them all to you myself, Matt.
But that's the point is like that's Fallout and Assassin's Creed are big franchises, but they're not Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. What can you can't keep counting on making $250 million every time you do this. It's not going to work that way. There's not enough franchises. And if you knew the hobby, you'd know that.
It's the same thing with like they like talking about the Marvel license. They just got the rights. They worked out some deal with Disney, which is mind blowing to me because Disney already has their own card game. They have two card games out right now. They have a brand new Star Wars Unlimited card game that just released, which is fantastic and plays very similarly to Lorcana. And then they have Lorcana, which has everything. Like literally every Disney IP is going to be in there and they're going to print it into the ground because they want people to play it. Like they literally just released a new set that has stuff from Treasure Planet. Like they know what they're doing. They have a vehicle to do their own Marvel stuff, but Hasbro threw money at them for whatever the licensing is, but they did it too late. People are Marvel like fatigued at this point. You can see it in comic book sales. You can see it in the waning box office for the Marvel movies. And I'm not just talking about the stupid neckbeards arguing about the Marvels, which was fantastic, by the way. But like people are fatigued. They don't want to go there. Ever since Endgame, people have been sort of checking out of Marvel. It's on the back end. It's on the decline of like popularity and pop culture. They're not going to give people
that they've deliberately said they're not going to be doing much this year.
Yeah.
They have put out, you know, we're gonna let it cool and see what, you know, come back.
Because they know they oversaturated the market. And now Blizzard's like, we're going to jump on this bandwagon. When they are themselves, the people, the owners of the IPs are like, we're going to back off and let things cool down. Like, again, they're just hoping that they're going to try to take as much money as they can. Again, bleed that stone. It's, I don't know, it's sad, right? It's sad to see the things you love come to these points, especially when they've been such a large part of your life for so long, especially like Matt longer than me, but like
that's only just because I'm older. You and I have been at this for the moment we were able to do so.
Yeah, 36 years for me, right? Like,
yeah, and yeah, mine is getting close to that 50 years.
Yeah,
but it's not quite, but I a solid 45 years.
And Liz, who comes into the hobby like relatively recently compared to us. Yeah. But also has a long history of these games being a part of your life. Seeing stuff that we care go down the tubes hurts. And I know that one of the reasons a lot of our listeners have asked about our take on the Hasbro thing and wanted us to expand upon it is because they feel the same way. And I'll say the same thing that I always say in this point is, again, it's not D&D that made D&D special. It's the people who play the game with you that make it those things special. Mm-hmm. Replace D&D with literally anything else and you can get there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do want to say one thing, though. I do think Liz had a really good point about, to a certain degree, we have to wait and see what comes out. We have to see what the new stuff is. One of the problems I have, though, is that the new stuff is still written by the people that are not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, so when we get the new stuff, it'll actually be the last of the old stuff.
And
like, in a weird sort of way.
Well, I was going to say, even the art stuff, like, we don't know what art was finished, and we know that they've already been caught using AI art.
Yeah, after they got rid of the art director. Does anybody else start to feel like it wasn't that they fired these people because they weren't doing a good job? It's they laid them off so they could get people who would object to ridiculous things out of the way. Mm-hmm. Like, I keep looking back at the OGL debacle, as Liz called it, And I think one of the things to really look at with this is that there were people at Wizards who told them this is a bad idea. There were people at Wizards who managed to get the brakes pulled and put, you know, fifth edition on Creative Commons. And those people are likely gone. And now who is there who can tell them this is a terrible idea? Because we're now clear that you can be the director of the most profitable thing that Hasbro owns, and you can make them money to the tune of $250 million, and they will still fire you just so they can do whatever they want, whether or not it makes sense, because they always believe they know better. I'm not doom and gloom on Wizards of the Coast or Hasbro owning D&D. I don't think it's all bad, but I do think there's a real potential here for the same kind of disaster that we saw at the end of the 2000s when they were putting out, like, I loved third edition, but they were putting out so many books.
We can see another TSR here is what it can basically boil down to.
Yeah. This is not a direction that is good, and it's not good because the people who are basically captaining the ship, this is going to be Sea of Thieves all over again. You know, this is what, to use a video game analogy, this is going to be Sea of Thieves.
Yeah, you're not wrong, but you are both right. We have to wait and see. And I'm not saying that it's all doom and gloom. We can only report on what we see. Right. So that's kind of where we are. Is there anything else you want to add?
Liz? I hope the next edition does well. I mean, I hope that it remains a good game, an easily accessible game. That's one of the best things about Dungeons & Dragons now is how approachable it is. But part of that is because of the easy available of digital tool sets, the way there are so many online play streams that make it easy to see other people playing. That's part of what makes D&D so approachable. So, I mean, I hope that it stays there and it's a game I can continue to enjoy, a game I can continue to play with my friends, because it's also one of the most ubiquitous games. So if you want to play a tabletop game, it's like, okay, all of my friends know how to play D&D. I guess we're playing D&D. It'd be nice to still have that kind of like North Star of tabletop role playing, that one game, you can always get a group together and you can always get your friends playing because it's easy to pick up and learn, and it's easy to find digital and online tools and content to play with. And if that dissolves, it's going to be more difficult to get games together. We're going to have, I mean, still, it kind of breaking apart right now does mean we've got a wider variety of games out there. But at the same time, I hope D&D sticks around. I hope this isn't as much of a disaster as it feels like.
And I think, at least in my worst case scenario brain, is not that D&D would go completely away. It's that Hasbro would sell WotC if it became become unprofitable, or would sell it off to somebody who would maybe take up that banner and run with it. Right. They've done it in the past. They've done it with other things. And if they keep going like this, maybe Hasbro dissolves a lot of their stuff, but it's going to be interesting to see. I don't think D&D will ever truly die or will go away because, again, even in the worst case scenarios, somebody else takes up that mantle and carries it forward. We have enough people that they love it. They've been doing this forever. There's people that have been making this game that still love it and still want to keep making these games. They're going to do brilliant things. People like us, we joked earlier about submitting our stuff for the BRP contest, but it's not really a joke, right? Like it's one of those things where like, I know Matt's legitimately considering it. I'm legitimately considering it. And I'm sure
y'all should do it.
And I'm sure there's hundreds of other people that are as well, right? Or thousands of other people or multiple other people.
Even if I didn't even win a place, I'd still be able to use their license, their engine freely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if I don't get any money from it, I could make the game and then put it out, you know? And that's something. It's kind of nuts. One of the things I wanted to try and talk about was there's some indie games I wanted to mention. Like I briefly managed to throw out a Perils and Princesses reference. That was a game I wanted to talk about a little bit. I wanted to talk about the Powered by Lumen system, which is one that I keep pushing because it's fascinating. It's like, it's a rules light system. And there's a lot of indie rules light systems. There's a whole bunch of superhero ones. There's one that's literally just called like Supers. There's a lot of stuff out there and a lot of people, you know, putting their stuff on the line. In a way, like the RPG hobby has always been a fairly indie place because it's fairly niche. I mean, the original Player's Handbook, the original Blackmore, setting, the original Chainmail, these were published on mimeographs, you know, they were like zines. They were made in like people's basement, and there's still a lot of that in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is why I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward. But I think we're probably out of time, right?
I would think we are. I think we're going to call it there. So I will say that Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means that this podcast signing community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your questions answered on our podcast with a queue, and an ads-free site experience. I do want to thank you for joining us on this rant-filled episode of Tavern Watch. Share this content with your friends, especially if they've been talking about this, and let us know what you think. Hit us up on the socials. Hit us up on our Discord server for Blizzard Watch. Let us know what your thoughts are on the current state of the gaming industry. Keep them constructive. And keep them respectful. But yeah, I'm interested to hear what the community at large feels about this. But with that, folks, we'll catch you next time.